Megan.
Hello, Megan.
Well, how are you doing today?
I'm sorry, say that again?
How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. I feel a little guilty. In order to tape this, I've had to kick my son off his Hanukkah present, which was a Wii.
Aww.
I know.
Wii is pretty excellent. So have you gotten addicted yet?
To the baseball, yes.
This is really, it's really a present for the grown-ups. It's the first video game that the parents like as much as the kids do.
Oh, no, it's true. And, like, you know, after the kids have gone to sleep at night, you know, I'll, like, mute it, you know, except for the little handheld controller and you know, take some good batting practice or something like that.
Well, my father got me the gigantic Rock Band, Guitar Hero World Tour thing, which comes in this huge box because it includes, like, a game drum kit.
Oh, my.
And so he said he went to the GameStop up in some mall, and, you know, my dad's about 70, and there's a couple there who, actually, I shouldn't erroneously accuse my father of being 70. He's, in fact, 67. But anyway, so he's in his late 60s, and there was another couple there about his age, and they were also buying this, and they sort of apparently exchanged these, like, looks of, ha, we're buying these for adult children. yes, I'm, like, I'm the world's oldest, most feminine 14-year-old boy at heart. But it
well,
is...
Have you been playing? Have you used the drum kit?
No, I haven't because I'm in the middle of moving.
That's right, yes.
Well, no, I don't know if you know, we had to pull out of our old lease, so we're now looking for a new place. So, yeah, we hopefully have found one, and we'll be moving as planned on Friday. But it's all up in the air and exciting. But anyway, because of that, it's sitting in a box in my sister's house, looking wistful.
Ah. Well,
but hopefully soon. Speaking of less happy topics, the condition of the world today.
Yes. As we speak, I'm sure Israel is continuing to attack Hamas. You know, this is not my favorite topic because, you know, I prefer topics where there might actually be a solution sometime in the offing, and there doesn't appear to be one here. I think what's interesting about this or what's worth talking about is what Israel sees as the end game here, at least in the short term. And whether or not this is – how this can be anything but a replay of what happened 2 years ago with regard to Hezbollah.
Do you think that ended up being – I thought that ended up being a public relations disaster for Israel and that they didn't, in fact, achieve anything that they wanted to
– Yes. No, I would say – I mean, on a tactical level, they did destroy a lot of Hezbollah's operational network, but it didn't matter. Hezbollah survived, which was all they had to do to claim victory. And domestically within Lebanon, there's no question they were enhanced in terms of their political profile. So, no. On any political or strategic level, it was an abject disaster for the Israelis. And what's interesting this time around is that it's clear that the Israelis, you know, have learned something from the 2006 lesson, at least on a tactical level, because, it's clear from the attacks that they had much more intelligence about what to do and where to attack in Gaza. What's not clear to me is whether politically there's any other way this ends but Hamas surviving and therefore winning politically.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Like, I 2 years ago, I was guest blogging for Instapundit, and I said this is horrifying public relations for Israel. You know, like, they kidnapped four soldiers, and Israel killed, 700, 800 people, most of whom were civilians, in retaliation.
True, although, it is worth remembering, again, they lost, there's no question about that, but in the first couple of days, it looked like Israel had achieved something, because what was fascinating about the attacks on Hezbollah was the fact that the rest of the Arab states basically endorsed the Israeli attack. Obviously not de jure, but, I mean, most of the important Arab states made very critical, you know, statements against Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. And it's clear from the reaction, at least, you know, among some of the Arab states, again, that there's no love lost for Hamas either this time around.
Right.
But, again, that's going to be in the first couple of days. And, you know, as the deaths keep piling up, and they're piling up at an even faster rate this time, I believe, I agree with you. I don't see how this ends any way but Hamas having, you know, a political victory.
Well, what's interesting to me, though, was, like, that was the U.S. reaction, at least, for the people who emailed me, which was overwhelmingly, people yelled at me for saying, this doesn't look good for Israel to be going in and all of these civilians to be dying. This is not,
are you talking about now or back in 2006?
Back then. Okay. They're not getting very much in return for all of these dead civilian bodies, whether or not they think that they're right. Like, it's just not helping them achieve any significant goal, right? Hezbollah survives, they get a political victory, Israel gets what? They get to blow some stuff up. Mm-hmm. And they get sort of the satisfaction of revenge, but they don't get any long-term political benefit out of it that I could see. And the fascinating thing was how, you know, there's a sort of creeping, you know, first you weren't ever supposed to criticize Israel for anything that it did to retaliate against Hamas because, you know, terrorism is bad and so forth.
Right.
And now it's like you're not supposed to criticize it, even if your criticism is, like, this isn't helping Israel, this is not getting Israel anything it wants. You know, the people merely saying that was taken as some gigantic, like, offense against the state of Israel. And I think that this is similar, is that, you know, you are seeing this fracture of people who are saying, even when all you're criticizing is the fact that, you know, Israel's not going to get anything out of this. They're going to rack up a lot of bodies, and politically that's probably good for the woman whose name I cannot pronounce for the life of me, the
head of Kadima.
Yeah, because, you know, now Netanyahu can't really run to the right of her. You know, I'm going to kill 1,000 Palestinians a day or whatever.
I think this depends on what happens by the time the elections come, which is, I mean, the way I think, the person I think this helps is Bibi Netanyahu. Because, as I said, I don't think there's any way that in the end Israel wins this politically. And therefore, you know, Ehud Barak, who's the defense minister, and the woman in Kadima, who's the head, are going to come out losers relative to Netanyahu. So in the end, I think, paradoxically, the futility of military policy in the occupied territories will lead to a hardliner taking control of Israel.
Probably similarly in Hamas, the basic futility of firing rockets that don't hit anyone. And getting 10 of your countrymen killed will make Hamas look like the heroes. So it's a fairly grim way to end the year. I mean, one of my questions is, why now? I mean, do you think Ezra Klein had said that he thought that what this was is that the Palestinians don't want to take their chances with an Obama administration, and that they're pretty sure of how the Bush administration is going to react to this sort of thing? Rather, the Israelis, not the Palestinians.
Right.
And therefore they decided to attack now rather than handing a problem to Obama that Obama might not resolve as far in their favor as the Bush administration does. I mean, do you think that there's something to that? Or?
Yeah, I do. I mean, there's no question that if they were to wait, you know, have waited a month or two to do this, it would have been much more problematic. And it's not clear Obama would have reacted. I mean, clearly, Bush has reacted the way if you were Israel and you were trying to write up how you wanted the U.S. to respond officially, this would, you know, the Bush administration has done that by basically placing all the blame squarely on Hamas. So there's no question about that. I actually think there's another, I linked to this, Shadi Hamid has a good post at Huffington Post, arguing why Hamas triggered this. I mean, in some ways, Hamas also, you know, played a complicit role by continuing to launch the rocket attacks as the ceasefire ended, knowing that this was likely going to spur this kind of response. So, it's a similar story, the story isn't similar, I'm sorry, in that it had less to do with Obama and a lot more to do with the fact that Hamas, as a governing, you know, institution, has not done terribly well. So if they can somehow, you know, create a bigger boogeyman or create a diversionary war, they'll go that route. So, this is one of those things where unfortunately, all the short-term political tactics appear to favor war.
Well, that's actually possibly a good lead-in to something else we wanted to talk about, which is, you know, countries triggering wars because things aren't going so well domestically. There's some literature on this just in the U.S. that first-term presidents are especially likely to trigger wars when there's a problem in the economy as they sort of go into re-election. Mm-hmm. This is sort of a general theory that seems to be pretty sound, which is when you have domestic economic problems, it's probably a good time to find a foreigner to draw the whole country together against them and not against the guy in charge.
Yeah.
And of course, this is a really grim time for the world economy. And I know that you've, because in fact, we're going to have some stuff on our website, a video with you, but
you know, it's already up, right?
It's already up, but it's not officially launched until that was illicitly found by.
I didn't know. I'm sorry, because I linked to it, but I linked to it because I saw Virginia Pastrell link to it.
Yeah, no, I don't know how she found it, but it shouldn't have been discovered quite yet. It's not a big deal, but. Anyway, so we had you in to talk about this, and this seems like a good time to elaborate on that. I mean, talk a little bit about what you think the world economic crisis means for the geopolitical situation.
Well, what you're talking about is diversionary war theory, which is the argument that, if leaders are doing badly domestically, one of the ways in which they can potentially stay in power is to launch an external war, to create an external boogeyman. That allows a rally around the flag effect. And I think probably the best example of this historically was the Falklands War in 1982 on both sides. The reason the Argentinian junta launched the war is that they were domestically ridiculously unpopular. And one of the reasons, no doubt, that the UK refused to negotiate about this was because Margaret Thatcher was almost equally unpopular in the UK, and it was not until after the victory in the war that she then called an election and was re-elected.
I remember that she won she won the war. The patriotic sentiment was riding high, and 5 weeks
and then,
later,
she
had another election.
Right, exactly. So that's always sort of been thought of as the paradigmatic example of a domestic unpopularity can lead to external war. And there's no question. There's going to be a lot of political leaders in the next year. They're going to be domestically very unpopular.
Can you name some?
Sure. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. I mean, first, let's consider the oil regimes. The regimes that have been heavily dependent on oil exports, to maintain their popularity and can't afford, because of various extravagant promises, oil below $50 a barrel. So that's Hugo Chavez and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in Iran. To a lesser extent, it's also Russia's leaders, although they have a somewhat larger war chest to defend themselves. But still, it's going to be an issue there as well. So all three of those countries might have an incentive to make mischief because they lack the resources to buy off domestic discontent. That's the first group. The second group consists of states that might threaten to break apart or that are in such dire straits that they will be willing to do anything to distract. Pakistan certainly falls into this category, as their recent troop movements from the northwest frontier to the border with India suggests. I'm trying to think of other examples of sort of failing states. I mean, and the other problem is not just diversionary war externally, but also, in some cases you're going to just have simple out-and-out riots.
You've already seen in Greece, and now did you see Iceland?
Right.
Is actually having these demonstrations against the banks?
No, I did not see that, but it's not shocking. But yeah, Greece is a good example. I mean, in some ways, this is Robert Kaplan's dream come true. And in fact, Kaplan has had an article, I think, in The Atlantic on Greece, where he thinks this is just the beginning, we're going to see a lot more of these. And so the question becomes, which economies are in really bad straits, and which ones have enough ethnic divisions or other kinds of cleavages to lead to conflict? And what's striking is that some of them are in OECD economies. I mean, Greece has riots. Belgium's government has been collapsing now for quite some,
Do you see any hope for that? I mean, for that resolving itself?
Belgium?
Yeah.
I'm actually going to refrain from commenting. I don't know enough. I don't know enough about the internal Belgian politics. And also, whenever I say the word Walloon, I start giggling, repeatedly. So. It's just a silly name. Sorry.
Just tell the Walloons that.
Just the Walloons. Yeah, that was my shout out for the Walloons. But no, I mean, I'm not. I'm hopeful it'll resolve itself. But I don't want to. I don't want to comment any further on that. So yeah, there's a lot of potential instability, and this doesn't count the fact that you're seeing the economy's dropping like a stone across the Pacific Rim as well. So. Yeah, there's potentials for lots of conflict. Now, that said, if you ask me to make a pinpoint prediction of where it's going to take place, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be so bold as to do that.
Well, I think let's talk about one that I think everyone's worried about, yeah. And I don't know whether this is the great thing about Blocking Heads. It's Freeform Jazz Odyssey. So you may just tell me that you don't know enough to talk about it, but China. This is the country that I think everyone's worried about, and you know, for a long time actually, I've been certainly interviewing the sort of crankish economists, but I mean serious cranks, I guess is the word. You know, people who are prestigious cranks. They're going against the received wisdom who've said, look, you know, China's banking system is held together with like bubblegum and popsicle sticks. Mm-hmm. And the minute anything goes wrong, the entire thing is just going to fracture into 100,000 little pieces, and the country's going to be in dire straits, and it's going to have political as well as economic trouble. What's your take on that?
My take is I'm less concerned about the banks. I mean, I 5 years ago, everyone was predicting the collapse of China's banks, and actually, you know, relatively speaking, they've been more insulated from the global economy than you would think. And also, China has enough reserves so that they can always inject liquidity into the banks. They also have such a low debt to GDP ratio that I don't think the governments are going to let the banks collapse, mm-hmm. and they don't have to let the banks collapse. They have the resources to commit to that. So that doesn't concern me. Instability in China does concern me a little bit. The economic growth there is dropping. Industrial production is dropping fast. Energy consumption is dropping fast, which is perhaps the most interesting measure because that, you know, covers the gray economy as well. The sort of long-term migration from rural areas into the cities is now reversing itself because there are no jobs now in the cities.
Right.
And you're starting to see, you know, more and more discontent. And what's striking is that even during the last couple of years, when growth was off the charts, you still had a lot of riots in China. It was just sort of this low level, you know. I mean, the Chinese government liked to talk about this, like what? I think it was 100 or 200 of these things every day or something, or an awful lot of them. So, it wouldn't shock me if you have general violence going up in China. And it's remarkable how in China, you know, one symbolic riot can wind up, you know, galvanizing, you know, students and workers into a larger protest movement. Whether that will happen this time, I don't know. I mean, I would put the odds at 30 or 40% of that happening in the next year, probably. Because China's been so dependent on exports to fuel its growth, and because the export growth is going to be negative for them next year, there's very little new sources of economic growth for China. And, you know, that violates the social compact that the Chinese Communist Party has with its citizens.
So here's a question. It's maybe a two-part question. I mean, the thing that I was thinking as you were talking is, you know, does this push China back towards communism in the way that, you know, communism has had a resurgence in some of the Eastern Union because people remember that, they may not have had much, but at least it was kind of steady. And they weren't in the upper echelons desperately trying to hold the whole thing together. So they're not aware that it wasn't, the reason it collapsed in the first place was that it wasn't sustainable and hadn't been sustainable for decades. And in fact, it's just been propped up by high oil prices. And I was wondering if China would go back to communism. What I was thinking even more than that is, like, where are the new crank economic ideologies? The socialism and the fascism of the aughts. You know, like, the 1930s galvanized this rise of political / economic ideologies that were supposed to be an answer to the failure of capitalism. Right. And we don't really, but those ideologies were in place before 1930. So is there anything like that, or is this going to be a different kind of crisis?
Well, I think the difference might be that the ideologies that you were talking about had, for lack of a better way of putting it, universal appeal, and that they presumably could be applied in any country. It's possible that the radical ideologies this time around are going to be a little more localized. I mean, certainly one would argue that radical Islamic movements are in part a reaction to globalization and the fact that countries in Muslim areas have felt left out of the benefits of globalization. Beyond that, you know, I think you're going to see movements rise up that are basically simpatico with nationalism of one kind or another. And part of the reason I think that fascism and communism played well during the 20s and 30s was it allowed countries, and remember, the kind of communism that wound up winning in the 30s was not the sort of Second International, we are all one party, global struggle thing, but rather the Stalinism in one country approach of communism. So basically, I think you're going to see ideologies that wind up appealing to nationalist sentiment. And this is, again, you know, and we talked about this in the Atlantic video. I mean, my concern right now is that, to paraphrase Nixon, we're all Keynesians now. You know, when you have Marty Feldstein saying, yes, for God's sakes, we need much greater government stimulus, you know we're living in a Keynesian world. And my one concern I've got is whether or not Keynesianism gets mixed with nationalism, which is to say that, that governments that decide to try to boost their economies will also enact measures to make sure that whatever they boost they offer does not spill over to the rest of the world. And so as a result, you wind up with much greater autarkic policies.
Do you think that there's a real risk that that will happen in the Obama administration?
I don't think Obama will do it as a... I tend to doubt that Obama will... Yeah, and I've been a critic of Obama's trade policies since he started running. That said, I also don't think he's, you know, the second coming of Smoot Hawley. So I don't think Obama in and of himself would pursue this kind of policy. However, if the rest of the world decides to start pursuing these kinds of policies, it wouldn't stun me if the Obama administration pursued some kind of reaction to it that basically, you know, ratcheted up labor and environmental standards, for example, as a way to effectively, you know, create new barriers.
So you think that there's a real possibility that we do what we did in the 30s and withdraw deeper into our borders?
I think, look, I would say that the trend is in that direction. I'm optimistic that it never gets as bad as it did in the 30s. And I'm certainly hopeful about that. But yeah, I think the trend pushes in that direction.
Well, here's something that we didn't talk about in our okay. Atlantic video. Entirely new content for blogging heads. what we didn't actually talk that much about is the multilaterals. You know, a lot of people, when you express worries about Obama's trade policies, say, well, you know, the WTO won't let that happen. But of course, you know, countries can pull out of the WTO. They never have. But you know, it's possible. We don't know how robust these institutions are. And what I've been thinking about a lot lately is the euro. And what happens when there's a really major national default, which is looking a lot more likely these days. You know, is Germany going to be willing to subsidize? You know, Germany has been willing to sort of implicitly subsidize Italy and, you know, some of the eastern states. But when that, if that becomes a really huge cost and their economies in the tank at the same time, are they going to be willing to bear it? You know, conversely, is Italy going to be able to stay in, you know, in a deflationary economy with a central bank that's absolutely obsessed with inflation?
I think it's the second. I think the second scenario is much more likely. Italy pulling out of the euro is more likely than Germany deciding to scupper the arrangement. You know, the Germans are still good multilaterals in a lot of ways, and I don't think they want to be seen as responsible for breaking up the euro. The Italians, on the other hand, might very well have reasons to try to get out of that kind of deflationary environment.
Well, economically, they've been having trouble with it for... Yeah. Sorry about that, Internet. We had a little technical glitch on my end, but we're back. And we were talking about the fact that Italy, you know, has historically, before it entered the euro, used basically a cheap currency to subsidize its manufacturers, which really weren't sort of cost competitive any other way. They don't have, you know, they don't have sort of Chinese levels of low wages or American or German levels of productivity. And so they've always used these competitive devaluations, which is why, of course, the old joke about trying to figure out how many zeros to stick on the end of your bar tab when you went to Italy. And now they can't do that. And their economy has already been deeply suffering from this. And they've sort of never really, since the euro took full effect, they've really never managed to get into a good growth position. They've just sort of anemically, they're like a patient on life support. They go in and out of consciousness, but they never really get healthy. And you know, can they withstand the global recession in the euro? And what happens if they pull out?
I mean, I think they can withstand it. I think it's possible for the euro area to maintain its control. The kind of instability you're talking about is certainly possible. I think a lot of this actually hinges on a group that we haven't talked about yet, which is the G20, which is to say whether or not you're actually going to have what's going to be required over the next year at least is a truly global coordination of macroeconomic policies. You know, the paradox of the euro has always been that monetary policy is centralized now, but fiscal policy is decentralized. And it's remarkably difficult to coordinate. One way in which it might be coordinated is if the G20 actually manages to get its act together and have a coordinated fiscal stimulus where everyone pledges, you know, a certain percentage and then honors that percentage. Whether that is likely to happen, on the other hand, is really open to debate. You know, if you take a look at what the G20 pledged to do back in November and what they've actually done, I don't think they've done a whole lot. It was clear that they pledged some kind of fiscal stimulus, and, you know, the problem is that beyond the Chinese pledge and the British to a lesser and the French to a lesser extent, there hasn't been a whole lot of actual action. Or the Japanese, I'm sorry, the Japanese have actually been very good citizens. But India has put forward a pathetic stimulus. Brazil has put forward a pathetic stimulus. I don't think the Russians have announced any stimulus. And the Germans, very famously, are being incredibly reluctant to stimulate the economy. And because the Germans are reluctant, the rest of Europe is not moving until they wait until the Germans do. And the Germans have said they're not going to wait until Obama moves.
And, of course, Obama's not really going to be able to move until March.
Right. So, I mean, the next G20 summit is in March, so it's possible that the dominoes could line up such that Obama gets something done and then that leads to cooperation by everyone else. But I have to admit, you know, what's happened on the trade front, for example, is not encouraging. I mean, the one tangible thing the G20 said they were going to do was not enact any new WTO inconsistent policies. And what's striking is that all of the BRIC countries within a month of making that pledge went back on it.
Well, they almost don't have a choice politically at this point, right? I mean, the emerging markets are all in big, big, deep trouble.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, the other option, which is actually the one that the G20 would like to see, is that they, you know, expand their own domestic economies, that they switch to greater domestic consumption. And in the end, in the long term, that has to happen no matter what. Yeah, I mean, you've got to remember, one of the underlying, you know, causes of all of this was the huge macro imbalance between the U.S., you know, on one hand, and a lot of the developing countries on the other, China most spectacularly, but a lot of the other countries as well. The only way that gets rebalanced is if Americans consume somewhat less and the rest of the developing world, or the developing world, consumes somewhat more.
Well, we're certainly consuming somewhat less. I mean, I don't know if you saw the retail data that came out last week from the credit card companies, but shopping dropped like a stone. Luxury goods were the worst hit category. But everything, including online sales, was off. Online sales was actually the strongest category. It fell 2%. Everything else was worse in November and December. And, you know, this has been mostly in the newspapers. It's been portrayed as a huge problem. Mm-hmm. And to me, just knowing the position that the U.S. consumers have been in for years, you know, this is a solution, not a problem. People have to spend less.
There was no way that they could keep going. Yeah.
And the fact that they're doing it now is, in fact, like in the long term, a good sign, because the sooner that people retrench, you know, the more able they're going to be to sort of get the economy on a sound footing in 2 years. It's not good for the retailers, and it's not good for the credit card companies either, which are, on the one hand, the credit card companies are slashing credit lines, but they need to make money off of their good customers, and that's increasingly hard to do.
Can I ask you, I was, again, just to do the freeform jazz thing, I mean, wasn't a law just passed that made it tougher for the credit card companies to raise their interest rates? I'm trying to remember what actually happened.
I think it hasn't passed yet, the last I looked. Okay. I could be completely wrong about this, however, because I actually, I sort of read about the law the way you did and didn't follow it because it's not quite in my line. I've been mostly concentrating on the automakers. The basic idea was, so I don't know actually what its legislative fate was, but the proposed idea was to prevent credit card companies from sort of changing, and the thing about credit card companies is they really are, that you do sort of wonder how their executives get up and look at the hotels in the mirror in the morning and manage to still go to work. But nonetheless, you know, so there's that, in fact, that they do just these, like, disgusting industry practices where they sort of bizarrely change the date on your statements. So they're due 3 days earlier, so, of course, you're used to a certain deadline and you miss it. They have all these fees for... but on the other hand, some of the things that people object to are, in fact, sort of very good financial practice that you would really want banks to engage in. You know, one of the biggest complaints that people have, actually, is that a credit card company, if you miss payments on other cards but are current on this card, will raise your fees anyway. Mm-hmm. And people perceive that as being necessarily unfair, but it's, you know, I think they're thinking about what a credit card is the wrong way. Credit card is a revolving loan, which means that you're sort of, in theory, you know, the actual theory of it is you're taking out a new loan every month, and so they're reevaluating what credit risk you pose. And the fact is, if you've missed a payment on another card or on your mortgage or on your car payment, you are a higher risk for them. People who start missing payments very frequently keep missing payments. Now, there's, like, a social justice problem, which is that, of course, if you suddenly get hit with fees and so forth, it now makes you even more likely to miss a payment. Right. But from the point of view of having sound banks that don't profitably lend money, in fact, you do want them to raise the interest rates on people who miss payments, because those people are, in fact, riskier bets. So that's, you know, by cracking down on the latter sort of thing, the former sort of thing is just unjustifiable. I mean, I have no doubt that it increases industry profits, but it's just appalling. It's, you know, it's deceptive in the worst sort of way. And I would, in fact, rather see Congress, like, angrily publicizing the companies who do this and you know, customers voting with their feet to go to other companies.
Right.
Then to have to pass a law against it, but, you know, that's neither here nor there. I don't think that I'm not really troubled by that. But the latter sort of thing of trying to prevent companies from doing risk management because people, you know, because people don't like it, obviously,
it's
problematic because we've got a banking system that's already in deep, deep trouble, and you know, making it harder to do risk management, making it harder to correctly price risk, that's the problem. That's what got us into this in the first place.
Right.
And you sort of can't complain that companies extended money to people they shouldn't have, and at the same time then complain that they're raising money, that they're raising the cost of money to people to whom they now realize they shouldn't have extended the loan in the first place.
Well, you know, to step back to the first question, I mean, you were asking about, you know, what does retail sales, or the decline in retail sales imply. I mean, part of what's going to happen in the U.S. economy is not just that people have to save a little more or that there's got to be a reduction in consumption, but it's also going to be, you know, a pretty strong shift in terms of which sectors are going to be growing and which sectors are going to be shrinking.
Finance, I think, is going to be shrinking. Guess.
Ken Rogoff a couple of weeks ago told me an extraordinary fact, which was half of the graduating class of 2008 of Harvard Business School went into finance.
That's about right.
But that's stunning to me, that half of all Harvard Business School graduates choose finance as a career. You know,
I could have told you that in 2001. It was also true.
Really?
I was in business school. Yeah.
I mean, it's just stunning to me. I mean, you know, it depends on, I guess, how you define finance, but, you know,
right.
You should not have that big, that's too big a percentage. And so there are certain sectors that are going to go, you know, relatively speaking, going to decline. Finance is one of them. I assume retail is another, frankly. Construction is probably a third.
Healthcare,
you know, is going to have
media,
to go
up. I think, unfortunately, is number four.
Well, we'll get to that in a second. But, yes, that's – I mean, unfortunately, the problem is I can tell you which sectors are going to shrink. I can't tell you which sectors beyond healthcare are necessarily going to go. Healthcare is going to go up. Government is going to go up. I guess education will go up because education, you know, it's kind of like healthcare at this point.
I don't know, actually. I really wonder at this point whether education is, and I wonder for a couple reasons.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, now, I mean, on the one hand, recessions are good times to go to law school and business school and so forth, and certainly there is a lot of that when
assuming you can get the student loans, yes.
Right. But that's actually a big problem. The supply of credit available to students is contracting because, in fact, most of these students aren't – I mean, student loans, they're interesting sort of creatures. They have an extraordinarily high default rate, but they also can't be discharged in bankruptcy, and they just mm-hmm. follow you. And, in fact, there was a story a couple of years ago about a guy who had defaulted student loan payments deducted from his Social Security check. So he was getting, like, nothing from Social Security and wasn't going to for 11 years until they paid back. Wow. And he was really shocked. And, of course, he counted on that for his retirement income. And, the government took his money. But also I think that, you know, the jobs, again, these finance jobs, these high-paid law jobs, those are, you know, the returns to education, if you don't have those jobs, drop dramatically.
Yeah.
Those are the industries that were making the returns on education be so high. Those, I mean, the returns to education are high, but I mean, the rapid growth in that return came in part from the fact that the average was being really pulled up by you know, people who, even if they weren't getting those jobs, were chasing those jobs. So I think you had very much like a lottery of people chasing these ridiculous jobs.
It was a superstar economy.
Exactly.
Thing. Yeah.
And so I think the returns are going to fall to education. I think that, you know, there's just going to be so much less slack in the economy for people's parents aren't going to have the money to put them through. They're going to find it harder to borrow to go through. And so I think, where is the money coming from that is going to let universities keep raising tuition?
All right, that is a very compelling argument, I have to say. Well, one of the things that's also going to happen within education, and I've made this argument a couple of times, is that there's going to be a shift in terms of, within higher education, of state schools doing better, relatively speaking, than they used to.
Well, have you seen what happened to Harvard's endowment?
Yeah, well, there's two reasons for this. The first is the endowment situation, which is, you know, paradoxically, the private schools had opened up a large gap vis-a-vis the state schools because their endowments had been exploding over the last 10 years, and now their endowments are exploding in reverse. So as a result, they have much less money to spend than they used to, and, you know, it's much more difficult for these kinds of institutions to ratchet spending down rather than ratchet it up. So there's going to be a lot of financial strictures placed on private schools. The second reason is that the students, you know, part of what makes a good school is how good are your peer students. And what, you know, what had been happening recently was that a lot of the private schools had done a concerted effort to try to bring in the very best students, you know, regardless of their class background. That's probably going to go away a little bit. Need blind admissions are going to disappear from a few schools that have pledged to it. And furthermore, other students that ordinarily might have been able to have the loans that would have allowed them to go to a Harvard instead are going to go to a UMass Amherst. And so as a result, you're going to see a lot better quality student going to what would be considered state schools.
Right. I mean, I think it's interesting to me to look back to sort of read about people from the 30s and realize how many really brilliant people graduated from City College of New York.
Right.
And I think that we're probably going to see, I mean, it's not that City College of New York graduates are stupid or anything, but I mean, you had people who were sort of top of their high school class.
Yeah.
And had parents who were college literate.
Yeah.
Who went to City College of New York or to Brooklyn College, who went to sort of local New York City schools. And part of it, if I can say this without and sounding anti-Semitic, is the Jewish bonus, right? Is that there were a lot of poor Jews around in the 30s who value education really, really highly and have been prepping their kids to become physicists at City College since they were two.
This has always been a phenomenon. When I taught at Colorado, you know, when I taught at the University of Colorado Boulder, that was the flagship campus of Colorado. And the very best students I got there, I would have always stacked them up against the very best students from Harvard. And the thing that they all had in common was these were incredibly bright kids who it either never occurred to them or, you know, for a whole variety of personal reasons, could not leave the state. And so as a result, they wound up going to Colorado. As a result, I think you're just going to see that phenomenon, you know, spread out. And so a lot, you know, the flagship campuses of state schools are going to be much, much better than they were before.
Well, that's good news for the state schools, not
yes.
so good for those with Ivy League degrees, but or those who went to small private liberal arts colleges, not naming any names here.
No.
But I mean, so what do you think the saving grace of education is? Is it a good time to go, or is it sort of a way that we're going to delay the inevitable denouement?
Well, no, I mean, the saving grace of education has always been that, you know, if you're in a recession, you know, particularly if you graduate college or if you're, you know, graduating high school, the advantage of getting an education is that you're putting off having to try to enter the job market, and presumably you're building human capital. These are not bad things. Furthermore, you know, despite what you're saying, you know, what you said before about law and finance, the fact is, since 1980, the returns on higher education, you know, the gap between those who earn a BA versus those who don't, have been widening at an ever alarming rate. So, you know, that incentive is, even if it's blunt a little bit, it's not blunted too much. So as a result, you're going to see a lot more people who are particularly uncertain about what they should be doing, you know, in this economy, deciding the one thing they can do might be, maybe, is to go back to school.
Well, what should people be doing in this economy, Dan?
All right, I'm going to give you the standard response I give to anyone who asks me this, Megan, which is to say, if I had the answer to that question, I wouldn't be talking on Blogging Heads. I'd be sitting on my yacht in the middle of, you know, the Caribbean.
No, you wouldn't. You'd still be teaching for the sheer joy of it.
Yes. Yes, he said, looking at the stack of papers he needs to grade after this Blogging Heads. No, I don't know. And this is, you know, I mean, back when I was debating people about outsourcing, I also had this response, which was, they kept saying, where are the new jobs going to come from? And I'd always say, if I knew that, I'd be much richer than I would be now. And anyone who tries to predict that as to where the new sources of growth are going to be beyond the government, which I think is what the source of growth of jobs is going to be for the next year, they're probably going to look pretty foolish in terms of where they think the growth is. And this is actually one of the dangers of a lot of the stimulus programs that have been talked about, because they're tantamount to an industrial policy when, in fact, it's far from clear that the U.S. Government has any better knowledge of where growth sectors are going to be than the private sector.
Yeah, I think you have this problem, which is that you know, the stuff where you can say credibly the government really does need to do this stuff, like the infrastructure stuff, mm-hmm. it's not good stimulus.
Yeah.
Government contracting programs take – there's little stuff that you can do really quickly, you know, and where you can mobilize unskilled people, which is essentially, you know, what you're looking at is almost a jobs program. I mean, that's a big component of the stimulus, is that the government is purchasing – you know, they're purchasing paint, et cetera, but they're also purchasing labor, and they're
right.
hiring people to paint bridges or whatever.
Yeah.
The problem is, though, that, you know, my dad pointed this out, because my dad's been in the construction industry for a long time, and he said, you know, people have this idea that it'll just be like FDR, but FDR was working with big pools of farm laborers who basically already knew how to do what he then hired them to do, right? You know, they'd already, they were day laborers. Well, are you going to take all the secretaries to the bankers from the financial industry and turn them into asphalt layers?
I bet a patent lawyer would be able to lay asphalt pretty soon.
Well, in fact, this is skilled work, which is one of the things, is that construction has gotten a lot more skilled in the last 50 years because it involves a lot more machinery. And, you know, like, operators go to school for quite a while to learn how to operate this equipment. It's not simply something that you get a guy out with, like, a shovel and tell him to dig a hole.
In fact, there's actually, correct me if I'm wrong, had been a labor shortage on some of these very high-skilled areas. I mean, I remember blogging about this a couple of years ago. Like Swiss-style machinists, for example, there was an incredible dearth of them in the United States a couple of years ago.
Arguably, there still is in some construction trades. And so that's one problem. The second problem is that you know, the contractors don't operate this way. The contractors, you know, people have been talking a lot about this backlog of state government work, right, that the states had projects that they'd already basically designed and so forth. Well, you still have to put it out to bid, because the price of materials has changed. Whenever this was greenlighted, no one is going to do the work, and no contractor has been sitting around on his butt with a full crew just waiting for you to, for the state to greenlight it. So the contractor has to, first of all, you have to put it out to, you, first of all, you have to put it out to bid. The contractor has to bid on it and then has to get the job, but he also needs credit. Contractors work on credit. And this is a terrible time to be getting it. So, you know, the government's going to very possibly need to provide some sort of financing thing, because, you know, a lot of the subs, it'll be like 120 days between doing the work and getting paid. You know, after you, in the way that the contractors get paid, the subs can wait. 120 days is long. But the subs can wait, like, quite a bit, and they need to finance all of that on contract, on credit. And so, you know, so you've got all of these issues. Then you've got the fact that the government approval, the federal government process, right, is Byzantine. And when you put federal money into a project, you know, my dad's commission estimated that it added 4 years to the, at least 4 years to the time that it would take to complete a project, which is why Amtrak's high-speed rail, which was greenlighted in, 1992, is now going to be completed sometime in the late in the next decade. So, you know, this is not stimulus. By the time, at the very minimum, you get the stuff bid out, find a credit program for the contractors, et cetera, like, you've gone way beyond any reasonable window for stimulus.
Well, I suspect, I assume what the Obama administration is going to do when it comes in is, you know, I was asked, I think, on NPR, you know, which kind of stimulus will Obama pick? And I think my response is, what kind of stimulus will he not pick? You know, my assumption if I were him, or if I was one of his advisors, would be you can't rely solely on these kinds of projects that you were just talking about. That presumably what's going to come in addition to that is direct aid to the states, because that will probably, you know, flush out much more quickly, and potentially a temporary cut in the payroll tax. And that those would be two ways that you could get, you know, stimulus immediately to the consumer,
right,
with the idea that 18 months from now, then the infrastructure projects would then start to kick in and have some effect at that point.
But here's the thing, is my sense is that politically the Obama administration is very interested in using stimulus as an excuse to do stuff that Democrats have been wanting to do for 25 years, right?
Yeah.
They're not interested in temporary spending. They're interested in making as much as possible all their permanent spending. Which, of course, is not stimulus. It's definitionally not stimulus. But that's neither there. So that stuff takes longer to roll out. You know, how much of the money is really going to go in temporary payroll tax that they know, like, that's one thing where they know they're going to have to hike it. You know, and they really don't want to do anything that they're going to have to undo. You know, I think that this really is a lot about an ideological commitment to growing the government. And, you know, like, certainly the political reporters I know who talk to people in Congress is pretty open about that, about this being an opportunity for them to really, you know, government is, I think Chuck Schumer is quoted as saying, government is back in style, you know. And so the stuff that you can do quickly is precisely the stuff that's easiest to undo, and so precisely the stuff that my sense at least is that Congress is least interested in. And a payroll tax holiday actually isn't, as far as I can tell, picking up much political steam for precisely that reason, right? They don't like tax cuts. No one likes tax cuts. And so there's other fast stuff that you can do. There's unemployment benefits, which I think any sane president would be doing regardless of whether they wanted fiscal stimulus, because you know, people are suffering. You need to extend unemployment benefits. I know, libertarians hate me. You know, and food stamps. But food stamps are like, they're easy to do, but they're also kind of stupid, because the real problem that people have is not getting food, it's making the rent, right? Like, and that's not helpful. So I just feel like a lot of this stimulus is going to end up being targeted at stuff that's both slow and not very stimulative.
Remind you that, you know, this might be a replay of what happened, you know, with the Bush administration. If you remember when Bush came in, you know, the initial tax program that he wanted did not contain a rebate from that year. But as the economic situation changed, that kind of got foisted on him, and he decided, I've got no choice. I mean, I would assume that the Republicans will probably get behind a payroll tax cut as their one, you know, suggestion, because it actually has the virtue of being a pretty immediate stimulus. And so for once, they would actually be in quite some time, they would be on the economic they would have the economic argument in their favor. So it wouldn't shock me if that gets latched onto as a compromise plan, whatever kind of long-term stimulus Obama puts forward. But I mean, that would be my tentative prediction as to what will happen. So all I know is that this is just one. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so here's the million or trillion dollar question. Who's going to lend us $1 trillion?
This is actually something that's not talked about that much, and it is actually one of the big wild cards, which is China at this point is still going to continue to buy this stuff, you know, buy U.S. debt. And it's not just China. Right now, oddly enough, a massive amount of volatility that's going on in the world helps the United States, because, again, as bad as the U.S. is doing, since just about everywhere else is doing worse, the U.S. dollar is still somehow seen as reliable, or at least U.S. debt is seen as reliable. So
yeah, I just cashed a small payment from the BBC, and it was distressing how much they've shrunk in the last 6 months because of exchange rate changes.
Exactly. So I mean, the fact is that, you know, what has been one of the sort of shifts that's happened over the last couple of months is that a lot of foreign investors, instead of buying what had been somewhat higher returning U.S. paper, for example, Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac bonds or commercial paper or something like that, they've all basically just switched to U.S. government debt. So as a result, the Fed has wound up buying up a lot of this stuff, and that's why their balance sheet is not terribly rosy. But at least in the short term, as long as investors, you know, are continuing this flight to quality, U.S. debt will still be relatively cheap, which means the U.S. can still pursue this kind of policy. I think the sort of moment of reckoning is not reckoning on this is not going to be next year. It's going to be 2010.
And do you think that we're then going to face? I mean, is it possible that I don't think they're going to end up in a sovereign debt crisis, but I can very easily see us ending up in a sovereign debt problem, where you know the United States for years has been the risk-free rate. At what point do people start demanding a premium on our debt because we've got so much, we're running such huge deficits?
I think it's going to be the moment when you start seeing pockets of growth elsewhere. If the U.S. if the U.S. grows more quickly, then there is a way in which this can become a soft landing where interest rates slowly go up, and therefore, you know, other investors will want to invest in the United States for sound financial reasons. But if other countries start to grow much more quickly than the United States does, and those look like, you know, targets for investment, then interest rates in the United States are going to have to increase significantly in order to attract foreign investment, and that's not going to be good.
And what do you think the odds are that we're going to have a soft landing?
I
know, if you knew that, you'd be in your yacht. But if you had to bet,
that's true,
if someone made you bet $100, what?
I'll say 50-50. What? I mean, it is remarkable how successful the United States has always been at externalizing its internal problems so that other countries have to make the adjustments that we've never had to. This happened in, you know, 2000 to a lesser extent, 1973, and before that. So it's remarkable how the U.S. has not had to pay the piper frequently, and they might be able to pull that off again.
What do you think the probability of another Great Depression is?
1 in 4.
Yeah, I'd say that sounds about right. Although I don't think that we'll ever see 25% unemployment again. The universe, I'm sure, will now probably reward me with like a 30% unemployment rate. And I've no doubt that I will be standing in the bread lines along with everyone else. But
you saw what Virginia Pastrell said about our Atlantic
video.
Yes,
that looking at it, you could tell that we both had jobs.
It was just because I was talking to you, Megan. I mean, you know, you have that effect.
Yes, anyone in close proximity. But, you know, I mean, honestly, I think that there's an element of truth to that. We do both have jobs. On the other hand, I'm in the media industry, and you never know with the media industry.
Well, I'm about to sort of semi-join the media industry since my blog will be moving to foreign policy.
That's right, and on January 5th,
year.
Right?
Yes.
Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you.
And I guess that this is a good time then to close with our predictions for the coming year. What are you predicting?
Here's one prediction or one question, which is, let me throw this at you. I mean, I have to say, first of all, looking back, you know, I did put a predictions post in 2000, you know, beginning of 2008, and I was very proud. I got Obama winning the Democratic nomination and the presidency, and I got No Country for Old Men winning Best Picture. On the other hand, I had Mitt Romney winning the Republican nomination, and I think I had Bono winning the Nobel Peace Prize. So, you know, I wound up batting about 500, but I did get the big one, which was Obama, and I'm kind of pleased with that.
What are the big questions this year, do you think?
Well, all right, keeping this within the world of media, one big question. Is Bill Kristol going to stay as an op-ed columnist for the New York Times?
I'm going to go no.
I'm going to go no as well, which leads to the natural question, too, who replaces him?
The rumor is that one of my colleagues is on the short list, so I
Ross
should
Douthat?
Recuse myself from that question.
Ah, okay. I'm trying to think, you know, I thought of Ross as well, but it's not clear to me if that would actually happen. I'm trying to think, because another direction the Times can go.
I want to make it clear that I have absolutely no knowledge of this, except that everyone comes up to me at parties and says, so is Ross going to replace Bill Kristol? I have no reason to think that Ross would leave our happy home to go to the New York Times.
Yeah, it's old media anyway. Here's another question then. What newspaper will go, you know, the Christian Science Monitor went completely web this past year. What newspaper will be the next sort of domino to fall there?
One of the Detroit papers.
That's fair. All right, I'm trying to think of other media questions.
There's the Christian Science Monitor. How far will advertising revenues? By what percentage will advertising revenues fall in the next year?
You mean across the board?
Across the board.
I don't know. I'll go 10%.
I'll go like 18. Okay. 18 to 20.
One prediction I will make right here and now. This is one trend. The internet is about to get a lot slower. Because what you are going to see is website after website coming up with any way possible to force people to see or watch ads. So as a result, increasingly you're going to have articles, if you're trying to read them, split up into like 10 different pages, and every time you click to the next page, there's going to be like one of those screens saying, you know, like if you go to a Forbes site, you know, when you first come to that welcome, you know, the welcome screen will show an ad.
I remember a journalist who shall remain nameless debating, who was going around and around with their ad team, which shall also remain nameless.
Yeah.
Finally, you know, coming out afterwards and saying, you know, as far as I can tell, what advertising really wants is for us to put one word a page completely surrounded by loud blinking ads with pop-ups.
Right. my point is that, you know, they've been able to resist that until now, but I think desperation for revenues is going to cause a lot of websites to go in that direction.
And I think you are definitely going to see desperation for revenues, although actually weirdly...
And by the way, Megan, have I mentioned how delicious this Diet Coke that I'm drinking is?
Yes, you know, Diet Coke, breakfast of champions. Actually,
this is true. This is a phenomenon in D.C. I'm stunned by. The number of people who drink Diet Coke for breakfast inside the Beltway is astonishing to me.
Do you not drink it for breakfast? I tend to think of it. This is the first thing I do every morning. I slither out of bed and go to the refrigerator and get a Diet Coke. I have a Diet Coke. I have like a pre-coffee Diet Coke.
I go for the coffee. Coffee is the first thing I drink in the morning.
Coffee takes time. Diet Coke is there right then. I guess I could set my coffee maker for... But I mean, as I said, I'm in the middle of moving. So here's another question, this sort of has to go with it. You know, the Matt Iglesias dust up at the Center for American Progress, where Matt wrote something unkind about a partner of CAP, and his editor came on and said,
with Matt's permission,
boss,
I would add,
without his permission, said,
no, with his permission.
Oh, with his permission?
My understanding is Matt was okay. That Matt was perfectly fine with Palmieri going on his blog.
But at any rate, she said, you know, I want to make it clear that like these are only Matt's opinions, and we love Third Way and so forth. And I think you're going to see, I think you're going to see more of this. I think you're going to see more sort of terror of angering an advertiser.
More what? Say that again. More what?
More terror of angering someone who provides your organization money. You know, I think it's going to get a lot harder to let. I think that journalistic freedom at some outlets certainly is going to get challenged simply because, you know, I mean, I know like at The Economist, it's no secret that they lost AIG and Johnson & Johnson and several other companies. I think all because of. You know, one guy, the New York bureau chief, who liked to write stories that were true. He was sort of an interesting right-wing muckraker. Like, he hated Johnson & Johnson because they hid the liver damage problems with acetaminophen, and he went after them and, you know, wrote a story that caused them to pull out of advertising. And similarly with AIG, he thought Hank Greenberg was scum and wrote many stories to this effect, and then AIG pulled out of their advertising. And The Economist is more than almost any other publication, has the luxury of doing that because they're profitable. They're really profitable. They're profitable on their subscription base and also on their ad revenue, which is unheard of in the industry. Most people, if they cover their printing costs with their subscription base, they're really happy. And I think, you know, as ad revenues are threatened, letting journalists, especially business journalists, piss off advertisers is going to be more and more problematic. And so I think that you're definitely, like, that's going to be a huge issue in the next year. I expect in the next year to 18 months to hear of at least one private scandal where a business journalist was told not to print something because
It wouldn't shock me if the way this plays out is, I agree with you, there might be, you know, which is unfortunate because presumably one of the ways in which you prevent bubbles from happening in the first place or from assets being mispriced in the first place is by having a free press reporting on, you know, business ineptitude or odd business decisions. So in some ways that actually might deepen the recession a little bit. And furthermore, I could see a sort of a knife blade property here, which is you see business journalists holding their fire if they're getting ad revenue from a company, but the moment the company is in serious trouble, then suddenly it's like a wolf pack, and they're all, you know, all the stories that people wanted to run but couldn't then come out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the business model of the media for the print media for the last 100 years is definitely in trouble in a lot of ways, and I think that's one of it, is that it's hard to maintain journalistic. I shouldn't say it's hard. I've both at The Economist and The Atlantic, no one has ever said anything to me about anything that I've written in regards to an advertiser. But I think that you've got this inherent question of how publications that are on the edge, and, you know, maybe I'm just lucky enough to have never worked for a publication that had serious cash flow problems, or indeed any cash flow problems. You know, I think it's hard for a publication on the edge to go and deliberately cost itself advertising revenue. And you see this, I mean, in some industries, right? In the beauty industry, it's already true. None of those they're big advertising circulars. They never write anything critical of any beauty product. The stuff could, like, friggin', like, burn the skin off your face, and they would write it up as, like, a chemical peel.
That tingling you feel is the product.
Exactly. That tingling from the moisturizer, pretty soon, the fresh new, you know, after 3 months on the burn ward, the fresh new skin. Is that going to be continued? And, you know, and it's always been sort of an issue in, like, automotive journalism and so forth.
Yeah.
But the Motor Trend, et cetera, have actually often managed to, you know, they write critical reviews of cars.
Yeah.
And I think that especially in, like, those trade presses that are totally sort of dependent on advertising from one industry, you're going to see a lot of pressure on the editorial lines because the media business is not doing well, and it was able to sort of force advertisers to subsidize its operations and basically truth telling when it was growing, and now that it's really in a period of desperate shrinkage, I really wonder if there isn't going to come a point where the media outlets with integrity are just going to start looking for a new funding model. But I don't know what that would be, right? Like, you don't solve the problem by getting private foundation funding or, indeed, by getting it from the government. You know, the conflict of interest problems remain.
Well, could you
just shift?
I mean, could you see a nonprofit model set up where basically, you know, media outlets wind up, you know, being run much more like philanthropies or other kind of nonprofit organizations?
I mean, I think you have
that, right?
It's not
like they're making profits now, but what?
That's like that's the political press now, right? Like the New Republic, the American Prospect, the Weekly Standard, the National Review, et cetera, et cetera. They're all, you know, these guys get money from outside. I think the issues with that are, you know, first of all, you then in hock to your funders, and you run into a problem that did, and that's working for a nonprofit. So why is he getting censored? Because the nonprofit also needs money. And if you're working for the government, you know, there would be government officials who would be mad because you wrote something. Maintaining editorial integrity is, you know, difficult in the face of needing money. I don't think that it gets around the problem. And the other problem is that then those places are always just perpetually starved for funds. They're always going out of business or about to go out of business. You get a few places that are really well funded by foundations. But in general, there's, you know, it's. I don't think it's a viable substitute for advertising. I don't think that you can do those places. They run on a shoestring. They don't do that much investigative journalism. I mean, think of trying to run the New York Times that way. I can't imagine.
Yeah, no. Well, on that cheery note, I'm afraid I must sign off.
Yes. We're all going to hell. You know, my business is in sad decline, except for my little corner of it. I mean, business journalism is actually doing really well, which is really sad. But
no, unfortunately, teaching global political economy right now is relatively exciting.
I wish we both had less exciting lives. Actually.
Yes, I agree.
On that note, it's good to talk to you, Dan.
Happy holidays and happy New Year.
You too. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.